I'd like to welcome Ari Schaefer. Mir Tashem, a little later today, it's supposed to be a delivery of Rabbi Schaefer's Sfarim, which there'll be one made available to everybody in Yeshiva. Thank you very much, Rabbi Schaefer, for that. I hope it's okay to say this. My first introduction to Rabbi Schaefer, I don't know if you remember, was when I was about 10, 11 years old, taking karate lessons in the big shul. But the next time we met up again.
I think you were a little sloppy back then, if I remember correctly.
And the next time we met up again, I was a CIT in Magen Av. And every year we took a trip to Niagara Falls. The CITs took a trip to Niagara Falls, and then I continued taking that trip a couple of years as a CIT counselor. And Rabbi Schaefer was a Rebbe in the high school in Rochester. I actually remember my Haruso I learned with for a couple of years, Rabbi Chaim Juni, who's now one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Cherry Hill, attributing his success in learning and being turned on to learning by having, as a result of having Rabbi Schaefer as his Rebbe in Rochester. And when the CIT trip used to go through Rochester, really the highlight of the Niagara Falls trip, believe it or not, was the morning shiur. We slept over in the yeshiva in Rochester, which is pretty close to Niagara Falls, and the highlight of the trip was getting to hear a shiur from Rabbi Schaefer. That's before the shmooze went public. I'm still within the walls of the yeshiva. And many of you have heard the shmooze and have seen the advertisements. We had this close to have Rabbi Schaefer here for a number of years. He's actually going to be in the community for Shabbos if you have a chance to chaperon a little bit more. I'd like to introduce Rabbi Schaefer. If I could ask the Talmidim who are sitting on the upper level to please find a seat down here. I just feel that it works better if Rabbi Schaefer could get in your face.
Thank you, Rivita. The Gemara tells us, "Lo'olam al yavi adam atzmo l'dei nesayon." A man should never bring himself to a nesayon, to a test. And then the Gemara explains to us why. Shrei David Melech Yisrael, David, the height of Kedusha, one of the greatest men who ever lived, brought himself to the nesayon. He brought himself to nesayon, v'nichshel, and he failed. And then the Gemara tells us the events. Amar lefanav, one day, David Melech says to Hashem, "Mipnei ma omrim l'kei Avram l'kei Yitzhak v'l'kei Yaakov." Why is it that it's Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov? Why don't they say Elokei David? Now, gentlemen, David HaMelech was not a Baal Gaiva. He was not arrogant. He understood who he was. He understood his level. There's Avram, there's Yitzhak, there's Yaakov. There isn't that much distinction. Why is it okay, Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov? Why isn't David up there? And Hashem said, "I'll tell you why. They I tested, you I never tested." So David said, "Bachanani, test me." So Hashem said, "Okay, I'll test you. But I'm going to do something differently than that which I did for them. I'm going to tell you the area of your nesayon. The area of your test is going to be arayos, illicit relations. That's going to be your test." The Gemara explains that it wasn't that much later when one evening David HaMelech is walking on his palace roof. And in a building down a way over, suddenly there's a bird, some noise, some interruption, something was very unusual. David HaMelech took out his bow, his arrow, and he shot this bird, but his arrow broke the glass behind the bird, and in the bath was Bathsheba. He saw this married woman, Bathsheba, the wife of Ashish Uriachiti, and she was extraordinarily beautiful. And he says to his guards, bring me that woman. Adoni HaMelech, my majesty, she's a married woman. She's the wife of another man. Bring her to me. You don't disobey the king's words because Chayav Misa, you're dead. His guards brought her to him, and he lived with an Ashish. Failed. For the rest of his life, he suffered embarrassment. For the rest of his life, he suffered the pain, but he failed this Nisayan. And here's the question, gentlemen. Why? How? How did Dovid HaMelech fall for the oldest trick in the books? How did such a great man collapse? What happened? And if you don't understand the question, it's only because you don't understand who Dovid HaMelech was. The Gemara tells us who he was. Towards evening time, Dovid HaMelech would go to sleep. And it's very difficult to know how long he slept because it's not clear. But by midnight, there was a harp over his bed. Midnight, a wind would come and gently blow that harp. He would awaken at midnight, and for the rest of the evening, he was involved in learning. He was involved, that's when he wrote Tehillim. The man was on the highest level of purity. The man was a Kaddish Kedoshim. The man wrote Tehillim. And if you're not sure who Dovid HaMelech was, I'll give you one illustration. We have a minhag. Shabbos afternoon, after mincha, you'll know many people don't say good Shabbos. They'll say good, but whatever, they won't say good Shabbos. Why? Because that's when Dovid HaMelech died. Close to when we eat Shalosh Shudos, that's when Dovid HaMelech died. And for that reason, people don't say good Shabbos. But would you like to know the story? Dovid HaMelech says to Hashem, when is my last day? Hashem says, I don't tell anyone. Please, tell me what day of the week. Hashem says, okay, I'll tell you what day of the week you're going to die on Shabbos. Gemara says, from that time on, every Shabbos, Dovid HaMelech would go into the fields, and he was involved in Torah, learning from Kabbalah Shabbos straight through Shabbos. As a matter of fact, when it was the actual Shabbos that Dovid HaMelech was supposed to die, the Sultan, the Malach HaMavis, whose job it was to take him, came to take Dovid from his body. But the problem was that Torah is mugging, Torah protects. Dovid HaMelech is sitting in the fields learning. He's so engrossed in learning that the Sultan can't do his job, the Sultan can't touch him. Hour after hour, until late in the afternoon, the Sultan realizes if he doesn't do it now, he failed his job. He's sent on a shlichus by Hashem to bring back the neshama of Dovid HaMelech, and he's going to come empty-handed. The Sultan goes over to a tree, shakes the branches, makes some noise. Dovid HaMelech looks up. He stopped learning. The Sultan got him. But gentlemen, do you understand what that means? From Kabbalah's Shabbos, all through the night, completely, totally involved in learning. No distraction, no ADD moment, no spacing out. Straight through the night, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3, straight through the day. To the extent that it comes close to Kabbalah Shabbos, the Sultan's got a problem. The guy isn't stopping. What do I do with him? He makes a noise, Dovid HaMelech gets distracted, looks up, he gets him. So here's the question. It's not you and me. We're dealing with a man who's on the level of Elokei Avram Yitzhak Yaakov. He knows who he is. He's right there on the level of Avram Yitzhak Yaakov. And this is the greatest test of his life. And Hashem told him the area of his test. This is what is going to make him. This is what his eternity is. How could he fail? How's it possible? And if you really don't hear the question yet, let me make it obvious. Dovid HaMelech had 18 wives. You have a taiva. I get it. I hear. You have plenty and plenty of ways to take care of that. How is it possible that such a great man, such a tzaddik, collapsed, failed the greatest sign of his life? And that's a question I'd like to see if we can answer today. And to answer that, let me ask you guys a simple question. Isn't it true that if I had a Gadol's Yetzirah, life would be so. If I had Rav Moshe Feinstein's Yetzirah, if I had Rav Chaim Kanievsky's Yetzirah, life would be so phenomenal. I'd be steiging and learning. It'd be unbelievable, right? Well, gentlemen, I'd like to share with you an interesting concept. If I had Rav Moshe Feinstein's Yetzirah, I believe that today I would be a serial killer. And I'll explain to you why. People fundamentally misunderstand what the Yetzirah is, what it means, and what it's about. And to understand what it is, let's focus on a very different concept. Since the time you're a little boy, since fourth grade, fifth grade for sure, you've been taught that a malach doesn't have bechira, right? Human beings have bechira, free will. A malach doesn't have bechira. Is that correct, gentlemen? Malachim don't have bechira, right? Right, good. Okay. There's only one little technical issue. That's not true. Malachim have bechira. You'll find many times malachim do things. The Gemara brings various examples where they're punished, they did something wrong. Would you like to know the difference between you and a malach? It's not free will, it's something different. What it is the following. Here is the greatest challenge of creation. Hashem takes you, the neshama, brilliant and insightful, the neshama that so clearly sees things, and puts it in a position to have free will. But what does free will mean? Free will means you could or you could not. But here's the problem. Every Avera in the Torah damages me. Every Avera makes me damaged and dirty and hurts me. It doesn't help me in this world at all. It ruins my this world and ruins my world to come. Every mitzvah helps me grow, helps me become a better, bigger person. How do you take a brilliant neshama, the you who I'm talking to, how do you take it and give free will? There's no free will because you would never do anything that damages you. For instance, let's say I said to you, here, let's say I pulled out a $100 bill. And I said to you, I'll give you this $100 bill if you put your hand in a fire for 1 minute. Right, I taught high school enough years to know the guy. I said, well, what about the 30 seconds, the $50, $25 for 15 seconds? Gentlemen, I guarantee you would not put your hand in a fire, not for $100, not for $1,000, not for $10,000. And if you think you would, I'll take you to the burn unit of any hospital, and you'll hear the screaming pains, and you'll quickly realize you wouldn't do it. Why? Because it's stupid. It's self-inflicted damage. You're going to destroy your hand. You would never do it. So how do you give a human being who's brilliant and insightful free will to mess myself up, free will to destroy myself? There's no such concept of free will. And to allow for free will, Hashem did something very, very interesting. Hashem took this neshama, pure, holy, brilliant, and put it into a body. But it's not just a body like a robot, like an outside shell. The body has a nefesh bahami. If you go in the animal kingdom, you'll find every animal has all the instincts, all the desires, everything that it needs to stay alive. But you see, when the animal's hungry, it will eat. It'll forage. It will do whatever it takes. When an animal has a desire to mate, there's nothing that stops it. The brilliant neshama was put into this body. This body has drive, desires, appetites. The I whom speaking to am in ever-confused state. One moment I'm speaking to Hashem right there, the next minute my mind is somewhere else. Because I'm not just pure neshama. I'm a mix of neshama and nefesh bahami, animal soul, and the I whom speaking to made up of these two parts, and these two parts are always fighting. One or the other gains primacy. One or the other becomes stronger. The more you learn, the more you daven, the more you give stuff, the more you do chesed, the stronger your neshama becomes. And the opposite, the more you give into your animal soul, the stronger it becomes, the bigger it becomes. Would you like to know the difference between a malach and us? It has nothing to do with free will. It has to do with clarity, getting it, understanding it. There's not a human being I ever met who got involved in something bad and 5 years later said, wow, I'm so happy I became a drug addict. Wow! Waking up on the floor in my own vomit, it's the best experience in the world. Whoa! Anybody who gets involved in anything, they stop thinking, they stop realizing, they just do step after step after step, and they wake up 5 years later, 10 years later, and say to themselves, how did I get here? The difference between a human being and a malach is a malach sees things with absolute clarity. Every mitzvah Hashem gave me for my benefit. Hashem is the meitiv. Hashem only wants me to grow and accomplish. Hashem loves me. Hashem warned me against these things because they damage me. They destroy my world here. They destroy my olam haba. They're bad. A malach has free will. It could choose, but what is? Never put my hand on fire. Never do that. And that's the great challenge of creation. How do you give Adam, as brilliant as a malach, actual, practical free will? And Hashem is very, very good at doing that which Hashem does. And Hashem did just that. Hashem took that neshama, mixed it in with a nefesh abahami, and now the I who'm speaking to you, I'm ever changing, ever confused. One minute I'm so there, I'm learning and I'm into it, and the next minute I am very, very far away. And there's this constant battle between my neshama that wants to grow, that wants to serve Hashem, that wants to help another Jew. Gentlemen, you ever notice when someone announces, you know, where there's a sick woman in the community, could we say to him, there's a part of you that says, oi, that's terrible. And there's a part of you that says, who gives a darn about anybody but me? When you find out about a friend of yours is in trouble, there's a part of you that says, oi, what can I do to help? And there's a part of you that says, I don't give a darn about anybody but me and my own interests and my own needs. And the fight of the human is which part becomes stronger. One or the other is constantly growing. One or the other is always changing. And if you learn to study the human, you'd realize that we start out about 50-50. And if a person allows his animal soul, his desires and his appetites to become stronger, become 60-40, 70-30, you could see human beings who walk around who are literally animals in the shape of men. And the opposite is also true. If you listen to your neshama, you learn, you daven, you grow, you use the Torah system for perfection, you change from 50-50 and now becomes 60-40. Your neshama comes to the fore. 70-30, 80-20. And you're at a point where you're speaking to Hashem, you realize things, there's a joy within your heart because you understand why you're here, and you grow and you grow, and that is the problem. What happens? What happens if you hit a point, 95-5? Your neshama is so there. You get it. You understand every mitzvah is my eternity. Who I am forever is based on my decisions now. And you see Hashem and you're living your life. Very shortly, there is no purpose in your life. Why? Because once you hit a certain level of clarity, you're like a malach. And malachim don't have practical free will. Because if you get to a point where you're 90-10, 95-5, you see things with such clarity that there's no free will. There's no challenges. There's no reason for you to be alive. And to allow the human being to grow much more, Hashem created an evening force. That force is the Satan. The Satan is a malach. He's on the job 24/7, 364. His job is to keep an even playing field. So if a person starts out 50-50, the son's given very little control, very little shlita. Let's say a person gets to 60-40, meaning his neshama becomes stronger. That little extra bit, the son is given permission to function that more. If he becomes 70-30, the son is given more control, 80-20, more and more and more. The bigger the person is, the more the son is allowed to come out of the box. Would you like to know what it means, Misha Godel Mechavero, Yitzro Godel Mechavero? If I had Rav Moshe Feinstein's Yetzara, I'd be a serial killer. Why? Because he reached a level of such clarity, such understanding that the Satan was allowed to really, really fight. And gentlemen, you may think you're very brave. You may think you're very tough. Try battling the Satan. Try one round. Try one punch. Try 1 second. Yeah, I'm a mach, I'll fight. Yeah, I'm not afraid of the Satan. Yeah, right. You like to know what the Satan is? I'll make it very clear. The next time you go for an MRI, most of you guys probably don't even know what that is, but MRI is a magnetic resonance imaging. It's sort of like when x-rays aren't good enough and they need to see on a molecular level what's doing. It could be in your bones, could be your blood, whatever, they're looking for something. They'll put you in this huge MRI. So it's a magnet. And it's such a powerful magnet that it literally pulls the electrons so that by shifting, the doctors are able to read and see what's going on in your bones, in your liver, whatever it may be. If you go into a building that contains an MRI, I give you a little challenge. Find me one of those. See that thing, the red thing on the wall? Fire extinguisher? If you bang your knuckles against it, you'll see it's made of metal. If you go into a building with an MRI in it, I guarantee you won't find the metal fire extinguisher there. And you know why? Because magnetic resonance, it's an electromagnet. It's such a powerful force that if down the hall there was a metal fire extinguisher, it would burst off the wall, smash through every wall between it, and clank into the MRI. They make special fire extinguishers in an MRI building that are not made of metal, because anything metal would come smashing through the walls, because electromagnetism is a powerful, powerful force. If you go to a junkyard, if you go to a junkyard, you see cars, refrigerators have been there, and a fellow owns a junkyard, operates a switch, on top there's this kind of, I don't know what it is, kind of like thing, it moves, and then when he gets over the object that he wants to lift, he turns on electricity, and it's an electromagnet, and pow, a car jumps off the floor and hits it. He stops the electricity, it crashes down. You don't see it, but electromagnetism is a very, very powerful force. Would you like to know why David HaMelech failed this Nisayon? The Sutton was allowed out of the box, full shlita, full control, total. And like an electromagnet being pulled, the power of the it was unimaginable. David HaMelech faced the greatest Nisayon of his life. Taiva was picked up, increased, literally like an electromagnet. He was pulled. Could he have resisted? I don't know, maybe. It was kind of like you and I climbing Mount Everest barefoot. I guess he could have, because otherwise it wouldn't have been the same. But the power of the pull, the tremendous, was so unimaginable, like an electromagnet just pulling him. And David Melech Yisrael, one of the greatest giborim who ever lived, was putty in the hands of the Sultan. Because as Mesul Sharm explains, the Sultan is a mighty, powerful warrior, devious, deceitful, and don't do battle with him. Says the Gemara, learn a lesson. Don't put yourself into Makom Nisayon. Don't ask Hashem for challenges. Use your head. Because you against the Sultan, forget about it. Okay, now this is interesting. What does it have to do with you and I? So, a number of years ago, I made an interesting observation. I lived in Rochester for about 15 years. And I used to take my kids, especially when they were little, regularly to the zoo. And one summer's day, I made the following observation. Behind the bars were various animals, monkeys, tigers, lions. In front of the bars were people. Now, why the animals were naked, I understood, because they're animals. But why the people on the other side of the bars were naked, I didn't quite understand. Because animals are supposed to be naked. That's what animals tend to go about. But people are supposed to be, you know, dressed. And the people on the other side of the bars were as naked as the animals behind the bars. And I said, I get it. They think that they're Adam and Chava before the Chait. Now, gentlemen, I want to share something with you. The way that people dress today in the street is not the way people dressed in the United States of America for decades, for centuries. Would you like to know that I'm right? Look at a picture, any picture of a woman from the 1920s. And you'll see any normal woman from any normal family was wearing sleeves down to the wrist, skirts down to the ankle, making a Frumis Beis Yaakov woman embarrassed with her level of tznius. It was considered vulgar for a dignified woman to show her ankle in public in the 1920s in the United States of America. As a matter of fact, Lane Bryant was a maternity wear clothing manufacturer. They make clothing for pregnant women. They wanted to take out an ad in the New York Times. The New York Times refused. What? She'll picture, even discuss maternity wear, pregnant women? It's not appropriate. It's not proper. Gentlemen, that's not quite what's happening in today's world. You know, I don't want to date myself. My mother grew up in the 1930s in Brooklyn, USA. And my grandfather was a regular balabas. He was a businessman. But she wasn't 18. And one day she came home and forgot to wipe the lipstick off of her face. She got a slap across the... Walk out in the street with lipstick, you're only 16, what are you, a prutza, what are you, a prostitute? It was a different world. It was a different world. If you look at America in the 1910s and 1920s, if you look at from the 18, for 200 years, it was a normal society. Women dressed as women, men understood boundaries. What you do in your private life is whatever. That's not the world we live in. Herbert Hoover began the FCC, the Federal Communication Commission, when radio became popular in America. What was the FCC? Its job was, as he said it, to double safeguard the citizens. Because now there were airwaves, and some crazy guy in Idaho, in Iowa, wherever he may be, could broadcast anything, and women and children should be hearing that stuff. And anyone know what a movie is? So anyway, in the old country, there used to be something called ratings. They rated the movie, okay? Movies were rated G. G meant general public, right? Then there was something called PG. PG meant parental guidance recommended. PG-13 meant even if your parents are okay with it, if you're not 13, you're not coming into the movie theater. Then there was something called R. R does not stand for regular. R means restricted. Restricted audiences only. This is not for Hamon Am. This is not for regular people. This is for restricted only. Until 1967, there was not one single movie that Hollywood put out that got an R rating. Because no one would go, no one would send their kids, no respectable person would go there. And by the way, in those days, to get the R rating, you had some cowboy standing there using a Chevy, met a word about... Gentlemen, you guys don't know this because you don't know what movies are, but I'd like to share with you that what you see today in the media, what people see today in the movie is abnormal. You'll excuse me for saying these words at the basement. Anyway, here, this is said on the congressional floor in a congressional hearing. Here's a statistic. The average person watching TV today will see thousands upon thousands of acts of cohabitation. Cohabitation means intercourse. Average person watching TV today will see thousands upon thousands of acts of cohabitation. Of those, only 1 in 7 will be between a husband and his wife. 1 in 7 between a husband and his wife. So what are the other 6 of the 7? Between a husband and another man's wife, between husband and maybe a wife and a wife, and husband. Okay, I don't know, use your imagination. But gentlemen, let me be very clear. I don't believe that the average young child in the United States of America is helped by that. Imagine you have 7-year-olds, you know, you have Billy, Sally, and Pete. And they're standing there, you know, they're sitting watching TV. The average child watches between 3 and 4 hours a day of TV. And they're going to see thousands upon thousands of acts of cohabitation. They're 7 years old. You know what psychologists call that? It's traumatic. Why is it traumatic? Because they're pre-sexuality. They have no ability to identify with it. It's like seeing something violent you don't know what I'm talking about, right? Let's go back. In ancient history, there was something called beetles. Not the kind you step on, but the... In the Midwest, they used to have rallies. Rallies in communities in the Midwest when they would burn beetle records. The parents would gather together, the church oftentimes organized it, they'd have a rally, and you'd see pictures, you could still see pictures. They'll bring all the Beatle records, make a fire out of them, why? Because the Beatles had these racy lyrics that were unacceptable, something like, I want to hold your hand. And this is not normal, we don't want our kids being exposed to this. Gentlemen, if the founding fathers of the United States of America heard the lyrics that pass today for music, I believe that they would shoot the producers, lock up the radio, burn down the radio station. It would be all over. Do you understand that this country was founded with great principles? George Washington, Jefferson, these people had tremendous recognition of the importance of family, of ideals, of normalcy, and there were laws instituted to keep the world sane. But the world has gone insane. Insane, utterly insane. I have a friend of mine who's a child psychiatrist, and he said to me, in the old country, let's go back to the 20s, the average family consisted of two parents, and eight kids. He says, the average family I deal with consists of eight parents and two kids. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, George and Sally get married. And they have two kids, and they get divorced. So George gets remarried, Sally gets remarried, and then that second marriage doesn't work. So by the time the kids get to my office, there are eight adults in their lives, eight parents and two kids. You wonder why they're coming to a child psychiatrist. Gentlemen, marriage in the United States of America is a failed institution. We're talking well over 50% divorce. We're talking about... I'd like to share with you, if the founding fathers of the United States of America would see the world that's there today, they would roll over in their graves. Because America was a great country with ideals, with honor, with dignity. You don't put women in the street like prostitutes. It's not proper. It's not appropriate. It's not normal. The fathers would shut, never let the kids back in the house. You're embarrassing. Okay. I one time answered Roy Harris's question. Harris, Rishivan, Farsils. I answered a kasha. I wish I could tell you it was like a deep kasha learning, you know, and I take great pride in it. I take a little bit of pride, but unfortunately it wasn't a kasha learning. Rabbi Harris had a kasha and he couldn't find an answer. Von Hullet found out that there was a Beis Medrash guy. The guy was learning, and he would go regularly at night to Beis Hazonos, to prostitute. Rabbi Harris said, how could it be? He learns morning said, he learns afternoon said, he goes to Shia, and then at night he goes to prostitute. How, it's not, how could it be? He couldn't understand. Rabbi Harris couldn't wrap his mind around it, couldn't get it. And I explained it to him. See, I was a little bit older than this fellow. I was kind of like a little bit of like maybe a mentor to him. And I explained to him what happened. You see, this fellow was grew up out of town. In eighth grade, he had a secular teacher who was a young woman. And this secular teacher invited him to his house. And she took advantage of him, whatever the case. When he came to high school, he had a very different background than the average high school student. By the time he made, he was in Beis Medrash, she also had a very different beginning, and I explained to Rabbi Harris what would happen. Morning Seder, he'd sit down to that Gemara, let's go! And he'd be looking at the Tosa, and he'd be right there, and suddenly an image would pop into his brain. Get out of here! And he goes back to the Tosa, and suddenly an image of a woman pops into his brain. Get out of here! And he'd fight hour after hour. By the time Shir came around, he was already fighting for 3 hours. And then he'd be listening to Rishiva's Shir, and an image comes out, get out of here! Back and forth, back and forth. By afternoon Seder, he was already exhausted. And then another 3 hours of fighting, and by 6:30, he was done. He was toast. He didn't just go to the prostitutes. He spent hour after hour fighting, and eventually it was just too much. Rabbi Harris said, thank you, I get it. Okay, gentlemen, when I was a bacher in yeshiva, for a guy to end up in a like a weird thing. How do you end up by a prostitute? It was weird. That is not the world that you were brought up in. And not that you're going to prostitutes, and not that your friends do. But I'd like to share one simple observation. If you took the gedolim of Sdom, you know Sdom and Amorah? Take the worst menuvolim, the real Cretans, the lowest of the lowest. Took the leaders, took the gedolim. If you brought them to our world and put them in front of an unfiltered internet portal for 30 minutes, the gedolim of stone would fall on their face. We were nobodies. We were nothing. You guys are steiging. You guys have invented things we can't even imagine or envision. And it's right there in the palm of your hand. Wow, we humbly submit to your greatness. We were nobody. We were nothing compared to you. I don't say this anymore. I used to say to my kids, maybe I shouldn't say it. It's not nice. I used to say to my kids all the time, I'm glad I wasn't born in your generation. Now, let me not let this be a depressing thought. Gentlemen, let me be very clear. Every mitzvah in the Torah is for our benefit. Hashem created pleasures as tools to be used. And one of the most pleasurable, appropriate activities is when a husband and wife are together. It's kadosh, it's holy. In the right time, in the right way, and you're supposed to enjoy it, it's supposed to be pleasurable, but it's exactly that. In the right way, in the right time. Judaism is not like this supposed to be a monk, go into the mountains and wear just rags and don't eat food. Hashem created pleasures for our benefit, but they're tools to be used. The problem is they get misused and they get abused. I was invited to a Shabbaton. Anyone know what Minyan Shalano is? It's in Lakewood. This is a group. These are fellows when they're no longer at risk. They're no longer youth at risk. They're way over the edge. So anyway, they have an organization for them, and there's a Shabbaton, and they asked me to join at the Shabbaton. And I'm speaking Shabbos afternoon to a group of 14, 15-year-olds, and for 2 hours I had them in a room, and we were talking, and I dealt with everything. I wasn't shy. Any issue, I dealt with it. And at a certain point, one of the fellows asked a question, and I said, I'm going to turn this one over to the person next to me. Who was the person next to me? The person next to me was 28. The person next to me had been a heroin addict. The person next to me went through treatment and et cetera. He was now married, happily and successful, et cetera. And he was a mentor to the group. The question that the fellows asked me, I felt I could not answer as well as this fellow could. And this fellow answered their question. He said, let me tell you about my life. I was young, I was strong, and I was really, really smart. And I decided that heroin sounded cool. And I used heroin. And the first time that I used it, there was no experience in my life that matched it. The incredible pleasure, the incredible high, it was unimaginable. So I decided the next time that I was gonna beat that high. So I did a little bit more. But I couldn't get as high as I did the first time. So I said, I'm not doing enough. So I used a little bit more. And I couldn't get to that same high. So I tried more, and it didn't work. I tried mixing other drugs, and it didn't work. I kept trying and trying to get that first high, and I couldn't do it. And I tried and I tried and I tried, and it wasn't too long before I was addicted. I was hooked. And it got to a point pretty soon where I no longer had any pleasure whatsoever from the drugs, but I desperately craved, needed to get high. Do you know what it's like when you're spending a lot of money and you have to get the stuff in your veins, but you get nothing from it? It has no pleasure, no enjoyment. You're addicted. And then this fellow went on to tell us another little story. He said, just recently, I had a kid that I wanted to get into rehab. From kid, Lakewood kid. The problem is they won't take you in a rehab place if you're high. They only take you if you're already not high and you're in withdrawals. They won't take you if you're high. And this kid was really bottomed out. He would wake up in his own vomit, retching, and he realized his life could not get any worse. He hit bottom, and we agreed the next morning I was going to pick him up. He was going to be sober. He was going to stop using, and I was going to take him to rehab, start his life over. I come the next day to pick him up, and he's high as a kite. I said, I don't get it. You don't have money. You don't have a car. You're 14 years old. How did you get this stuff? And would you like to know the answer how he got this stuff? When you start withdrawals, you start shaking. You start trembling. It's way worse than the worst flu you can imagine. You get fever. And his mother saw him. And his mother saw her son suffering. She took him, put him in her car, drove him, and with her money he bought drugs so he could stop the horrible pain of withdrawal symptoms. And so this mentor said, you want to be smart and you want to be wise, let me let you understand what addiction is all about. Gentlemen, I'm not afraid that any of you are going to become heroin addicts. But I want you to understand something, that today there are major movements of young men, Gentile, non-Jewish, against an addiction that people don't realize. It's called pornography addiction. Hundreds of thousands of members to various different groups, on web, online, offline, because when you become addicted, and that's how they describe it, needing and craving, but no longer enjoying it, but having to do it literally like an addiction. And it's the most obnoxious, destructive. You know what it's like all day long to lust and desire and hunger, and you can't fulfill it anyway. And by the way, if you're Gentile, so you could have a girlfriend, if you're getting the pleasure from your girlfriend because you're only thinking about pornography. and she's not enough, and that one's, and it doesn't work. It no longer works, and their life becomes not a life. Gentlemen, one day, a good number of years from now, you'll meet someone. And this someone, you develop a certain connection to, and after a while, you'll probably feel about this person like you've never felt about anyone else in your life before. And you and she make a commitment to spend the rest of your life together. And you get married. And you're happily married. 3 months into your marriage. Life is great. She's wonderful. Everything's great. Everything's fine. And then you find out that she's having an affair. Another guy. How could you do that? It's treason. We had a commitment. We had a bond. How is it possible? I think you'd be outraged. I assume you'd be like, and even if it wasn't an affair, if you just found out that she was thinking about other men, dreaming about other men, I think you'd be aghast. How could you be so treasonous? How could you be so rebellious against what we have going? So, let me share with you. I'm not afraid that you're going to get married and your wife is going to have an affair. I'm not afraid that you'll get married and your wife is going to be dreaming about other men. Because assuming you're a mensch and you treat her nicely, you're kind, and you learn what she needs, and she's happy, she's not going to have eyes for other men. You, on the other hand, I'm not so sure about. My kids woke me up one evening. It wasn't so evening-like, much more like middle of the night-like. Mrs. So-and-so's at the door. Mrs. So-and-so's at the door. So I got dressed, came down. Why was Mrs. So-and-so at the door? Because Mrs. So-and-so finally found out what I had known for years, that her husband is having an affair regularly, but not just with one woman, with this one and that one, that one. But here's the point. I know him very well. I know her very well. He loves his wife. 4 kids. And could not keep his hands off of other women, ended up losing everything in his life. His wife, his kids. How? How could you do? What are you thinking? And I'm telling you, I know him very well. He loves his wife, loves his kids, and is now whatever. And the answer is very simple. An addict is an addict is an addict. Gentlemen, the fight of your life is this thing, this little device. It's everywhere. It's not even a device anymore. It's everywhere. And what I want to share with you is that people fundamentally misunderstand what it's about. I'm young, whatever. I'll do things now. And, you know, later on, I'll be better. I'll change. I'll do. Yeah, right, right. It's kind of like doing heroin for a little bit. I'll just do a little heroin. It won't be too devastating. Not me. I'll never get addicted. Not me. So here's the great Yesod. The great Yesod is, it's not fun even. Oh yes, it's something you pull towards, but that pull is not healthy. Giving into that pull doesn't make you happy and doesn't make you a better person. Quite the opposite. The more you give in, the more the pull becomes, the more you desire it, the more you need it. So what am I saying to you guys? If you don't begin working on it now, don't be surprised. Everyone thinks, well, I'll get married and everything is perfect. I love her. She'll love me. I'll never think of another woman again. Yeah, right. Now, if you work on it now and you fight, and I don't mean win every battle, I don't mean become a tzaddik, but you recognize that there is a battle and you work on really winning some and knowing what losing some means also, you get married and life changes. It's a different battlefield. But if you don't work on it now, things continue, it's a slippery slope. I'll get married, it'll all be fine. You'll get married, but it won't all be fine. I cannot tell you how many men call me on a regular basis. They're on porn sites for an hour a day or more. I can't tell you how many women call me when they find out that their loving husband has been watching whatever. But these are from guys. Good husbands, not creeps, not Bowery bums sleeping in the street, hush of jobs, community members, many times community leaders. How could it be? How? How could it be? Good morning, America. This is the fight of the generation. And if you don't understand that it's a fight, you're clueless. You're living in la-la land. Yeah, whatever, I just go, yeah, what? I just want to see the movie, yeah, yeah. She's not that attractive. Okay. So, if you fight this fight, and it doesn't mean winning every battle, but if you recognize it's a fight, whatever I've done up to now, I'm not going further, and you stop, and you try to stop, and you'll win some, you'll lose some. Hashem helps. And when you get married, it's a different world, and you still have to fight. It doesn't just automatically disappear, but it's a whole different world. And you could be normal, and you could be happily married, and you can enjoy being with your wife, having pride in the sense that you're a man who's able to resist. I love these Gibor Chayil. Oh, I'm not addicted to pornography until you watch the guy getting a haircut. Ness's Barbershop in Rochester, I pass it all the time because it's a plate glass window right over here. And I love watching the big Giborim men when they get a haircut. So Ness is the barber, and Ness has his hand over here, and a pretty girl passes, and the guy goes, and Ness brings the guy's head back. And his head goes here, and Ness brings the guy's head back. I think the guy, Ness is going to cut his neck off. The guy's married, 35 years old. He is a behemoth in lust. When a dog is in lust, it has no self-control. It can't win that fight. Men, human beings, that you will witness, wear clothes like a human being, speak like a human being, are animals in human form. And is it fun? If you don't believe it's not fun, go online and read the testimony of guys who become addicted. Guys, their freedom, what could be better? I do whatever I want, when I want, as I want. And he gets involved, and becomes addicted to whatever it is, and he can't stop thinking about her or it or whatever, and over in his brain all day long, and he's a slave. If you're a slave to a bottle, you're a slave. If you're a slave to a needle, you're a slave. If you're a slave to desire, you're a slave. Slavery isn't fun. And now, the one Gemara that the Sultan doesn't want you to know. Quickly, put your head down, don't listen to this part. Here we go. It's a Gemara Makas. If a person is in a Nisayan, and he resists, person's in a test, and he resists and doesn't fall, he's given reward as if he fell. Meaning to say, let's say a man was having an affair with a woman. Eishazish, a horrible affair, Chay Misa. If he's in that situation and he resists, he's given the reward for resisting as bad as the Aveira was, that much reward he's giving for resistance. Day after day, week after week, even if he later fails. So if Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, he's a Gibor Chayil and he doesn't get involved with her, he's given reward, tremendous, unimaginable reward, even if on Thursday he blows it. And it's exactly the same thing with looking at things, whether devices or whatever it may be. Every time you resist, every time you don't look, you're strengthening yourself, and you're proving yourself to be a man. You're given reward that's unimaginable. The problem is that we aren't allowed to celebrate our victories. And the one thing the Sultan doesn't want you to feel is good. But if you could recognize what it means to be a Gibor, what it means to be a fighter. Everyone thinks a fighter, he's the biggest, strongest, toughest guy. I can tell you from the hard lessons I learned, the best fighter is not the guy with all the scars. The only fighter to really be afraid of is the guy who's really clean-faced. Because if a guy's got lots of scars, it means he got hit lots of times. It's a guy who fights often, but he's clean-faced, no scars. That guy knows how to fight. That guy is, you better be careful around. Gentlemen, you got to be smart. You got to understand you're not Mr. Superman. If your friend has an iPhone without filters, you have to recognize it's a huge danger. Because I don't care who you are, it's pop-ups, it's ads, everything, it's there. If you have an iPhone without filters, you're in mortal danger. Don't tell me, oh, I don't look. I don't look. Gentlemen, if you walk in the streets and you don't desire women that you see, you're not normal. If you walk in the streets and you don't fight against not looking, you're not a man. But you gotta be smart. You gotta make sure that you have filters. If you have to have the device, if you have to have it, you make sure that there are filters, and you understand that the filters are things I put on to protect me. I don't want to end up there. And you do whatever you can. You get rid of whatever access in the ways that are dangerous. If you have a computer at home, you do what you can. If you don't know how to do it, most guys are pretty good at breaking into filters. But if you don't know how to put a filter on, because I recognize it's not something I've ever put a filter on, I'm always, getting around my parents' filter. So if you don't know how to put a filter on, some of your friends will help you. If not, you could call TAG, Technology Awareness Group, but I think you guys are smart enough to know. But this is the point. Use your head. You don't need it. It doesn't help you. David Melech Yisrael lost the biggest battle of his life. Why? Because the Sultan was allowed out of control. Gentlemen, today, in the streets of the United States of America, the Sultan is out of control. Today, on a device that's in your pocket, in your hand, in front of that computer screen, the Sultan is out of control. You can go to the sewers of Bangkok, of Hong Kong, of Taiwan in a heartbeat. And the Gedolim of stone would be so humble. Because in the course of history, there never was this level of just right in your face. In your face. And if you don't actively fight it, if you don't stand up like a man, you're toast. If you're in yeshiva, I have a strong recommendation. Besides learning and davening, you have Rebbeim. You have Rebbeim who are living in your world. A little bit older, a little bit wiser, hopefully a little bit holier. Speak to them. It's not exactly something most guys are proud of. But if you recognize that this is normal, this is a generation, and you're not supposed to be Shimshon. You speak to Rebbe, ask advice, ask help. And you'll find a lot of times that your understanding may not be correct. And you'll understand that victory doesn't mean I'll never look at anything ever. It means I'm going to grow. I'm going to put in gedurim, parameters. I'm going to step away slowly, slowly. You got a plan? It's a major fight. Winning that battle is the most enjoyable thing you do in life. There's a pride, there's a strength when you stand up. You know what it's like to stand up and say, I won. It's true, I lost yesterday. I lost the day before, but I won this battle. It's me and me, and no one else knows, but I fought it and I won. It's true, I may fall tomorrow, that's right, but I won this one. It's the greatest feeling in existence. It's what you'll put on the planet for eternity. It's what you become based on. And this is Murray sharing with us a tremendous insight. And I want to close with one last thought. Here's the question, gentlemen. Final question of the day. The question is, what bridge did David HaMelech jump off of? Which bridge? Right? I mean, he blew it. Melech B'Yisrael lives in an Ashes East. The entire Klal Yisrael knew everyone. Madnish to Makin. When David, as a Melech, would walk into the Beis Medrash, they would start asking questions. What's halacha about living in an Ashes East? What's halacha? They would embarrass him in public. By the way, for that, they were chayim misa. They could have killed him instantly. But you know the embarrassment that he felt? Read the words in Tachanun, and we say them every day. We said them today. Yagati ban chasi. My trembling was so powerful, I almost couldn't say. My bed was filled with tears. For the rest of his life, he suffered embarrassment. He suffered pain. So here's the question. The anointed David Melech B'Yisrael, in front of the whole Jewish nation, fails. What bridge did he jump off of? He obviously killed himself, right? It's over. David Mashiach, forget that stuff. Forget it, it's over. You're toast, you're a loser, you failed, you lost. Quit your job, retire. Oddly enough, David didn't jump off a bridge. Oddly enough, of the seven greatest human beings who ever lived, one of them is David HaMelech. Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, David. A little bit of my focus in what number, six or seven, but he's up there in the greatest of the greats. In the course of history, there were seven great men. David HaMelech is right up there. I don't understand. Why didn't he jump off the roof? You know why he didn't jump off the roof, gentlemen? Because he understood one idea, one principle. When he looked in the mirror, he saw someone who failed. And he said to himself, I failed, but that doesn't mean I'm a failure. I failed. I blew it. I messed up. I failed this Nisayon. But that doesn't mean I'm a failure. There are many other things I do well. many other things I accomplished, and I could do tshuva on this, and let's get to work. The average person, when they look in the mirror, do one of two things. Either they say, me failed, no way. I could resist if I want, I just don't care. Or actually, or they self-implode. I failed. Look what I did. I failed. I'm a worthless nothing. I am a failure. The ability to look in the mirror and say, I failed. I blew it. That's correct. Hashem gave me this desire. I didn't ask for it. Hashem put me into this generation. I didn't ask for that. And I failed this Messiah. But that doesn't mean I'm a failure. I'm a fighter. I'm getting back into the round next time, next week. I have many other things I succeed in. I'm going to battle this and let's go on. And gentlemen, that is so the Sultan doesn't want you to know. To recognize you could fail, it doesn't mean you're a failure. You set new goals, try again. Daven, ask your Rebbeim for help. And daven for Mashiach, may Hashem help us. Groom.